From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Welcome back to the show and happy Pride Month. As we celebrate Pride and approach summer, one thing is on my mind.
So I don't know what's come over me, but I feel like the only thing I'm listening to these days is lesbians. Lesbianism. First it was Renee Rapp, who I've never felt like I wanted to be more like than anyone else in my life. Then it was Chappell Roan, who makes me feel like I'm 16 again. And now Billie Eilish. They're killing it. I love it. And as I sit here looking out at the window, I do wonder to myself, do I want to eat a girl for lunch?
I have to agree. It feels like we're in a moment for unapologetically queer music in the mainstream. And this is especially true of queer femmes in the industry, who are seemingly reaching pop stardom. I wanted to know if others were noticing this moment too. So I called up some fellow ACLU music lovers who, like me, are also creatures of the internet.
I'm so excited to be here. Stephen Smith, head of digital engagement here at the ACLU, and I'm just such a huge music fan, and the moment we are experiencing right now with this like queer resurgence we're getting, it's everything the sort of closeted 12-year-old in me wanted, and I'm now getting it in my late 30s-ish.
My name is Jillian Brandstetter. I'm the communication strategist for the ACLU's LGBT work, and I've always been an obsessive about music and music history, and I'm also especially interested in any space where queer politics meets culture.
In this episode, you'll hear Stefan, Jillian, and I chop it up about what we've been noticing in the world of queer music and some of our favorite artists. Later, we're joined by music journalist Sasha Geffen.
I'm the author of Glitter Up the Dark, How Pop Music Broke the Binary. I've been writing about the intersection of pop music and gender expression for a while now. Just been a freelance music critic and journalist for spots like Pitchfork, NPR, and others.
They'll help ground this moment in the rich history of American popular music, introduce us to its queer trailblazers, and help explain how we got to where we are today. We're going to dig into kind of all the different layers of this moment, but I want to just ask a top line question to you both of like, does this actually feel like a moment to you? You know, I think this perhaps isn't the only moment we've ever had in history where we've had this kind of collection of queer artists kind of rising to the top. But does this feel like a special moment to you as I'm receiving it, or is that other folks on the internet are receiving it?
I think you're right that, you know, there is a particular reason why queer music feels like it is particularly inescapable. Queer folks have always been at the front of innovations in popular music across the last century. And there have been sort of peak moments where, you know, you could turn on the radio, or I guess now open the homepage of Spotify and see a long cadre of queer folks who are dominating popular music, dominating the charts, and innovating in new and exciting ways. And when I think of right now, at the era that actually comes to mind for me is the 1970s, the 1980s, when you could turn on the radio and you could hear David Bowie, you could hear Freddie Mercury, you could hear Prince, right? You could hear disco music, you could hear the Pet Shop Boys, you could hear all this music that was coming from extremely vibrant, extremely diverse queer communities from not just around the country, the United States, but really from around the world. And at that same time, you were seeing both a surge in queer politics with rise of groups like Gay Liberation Front, with the rise of more mainstream gay rights movement. So at the same time, you know, this is something that has unified the queer community in the US for a really long time, that when we are facing our greatest hardships, when we are facing our most dire backlashes, that's also when we are most vibrant creatively. That is also when we recognize the true power of our expression, of our joy. And it's always very interesting to me to see when and how that reaches mainstream success, like a lot of the artists in the present day now.
Are we in a moment of increased representation and visibility for queer artists? Yes. But what do they all have in common? They are all a certain type of artist for a certain type of white audio consumer, right? Like, when we think about this moment, I would be very hesitant about us sort of branding this as this larger moment of increased visibility that has lifted all queer artists' boats similarly, in the same way that like racial politics plays out in every consumer part of our society, right? And the ways in which like audiences prioritize certain types of content and certain types of artists, like how many Black Chapel Roans have there been waiting for their moment? You know what I mean? And so when we are thinking about this basket of artists and when we are thinking about this queer moment, I don't want to take anything away from what is happening to, you know, groups like Muna and Boy Genius and like all the, and like really, really good stuff. While also saying this moment is not as inclusive as it could be. It could be bigger. And like that moment in the 70s and 80s, it is still also lacking some racial diversity.
For queer artists of color, this moment has taken longer to reach. Take pop icon Victoria Monet, who got her overdue flowers as a solo artist during this year's Grammy Awards season. She opened up about hiding her sexuality before coming out as bisexual in 2018, citing concerns about the potential negative impact it could have on her career. Or Canadian singer-songwriter Alison Russell, who was denied a proclamation to honor her Grammy Award win by the Tennessee House GOP, which she believes was because of her queer identity. Like all aspects of our culture, the music industry continues to be impacted by socially constructed ideas of race, sexuality, and gender. Sasha Geffen says this is a long-standing fact, one that the Black queer woman who pioneered American pop music transcended in the 1920s and 30s.
If you go back 100 years, right, to the early decades of recorded music, you'll see some pretty explicit lyrics about women having sex with other women. Like, if you look at the work of Lucille Bogan, Ma Rainey, you know, Gladys Bentley, all that was there, like, in kind of the earliest, what we can now say were pop hits at the time. I mean, really, they shaped all pop music kind of from the get-go. I think the history of the American recording industry in particular is the history of an industry that thrives on otherness. There's this kind of display of otherness, of voices that sounded quote unquote different to the mainstream, you know, voices that originated in Black traditions, being sold and marketed to white people as well as Black people. And I think the queer voices that you hear from this era are part of that too. There were blues singers, like I mentioned before, Lucille Bogan, Ma Rainey, who had this very androgynous sound to their voices.
I had no loving, but God loved
me. You know, women who sang, had deep voices, had this like gravel and grit to their voices, and many of them would perform in men's clothing or suits or outfits that kind of nodded to drag or were fully in drag. Like Gladys Bentley is a performer that I always go back to just because the images from their career are so powerful to me. Just like the white tails and the top hat and just the glamour of that performance is just kind of seared in my mind. And another figure that I think is important to mention is Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the pioneering guitarist who kind of set the stage for the electric guitar as an instrument. She was a gospel singer and played guitar in the blues tradition. And a lot of the musical phrases that became central to rock and roll came from her work. She, I think, is the first person that we know of to do the windmill move that later became associated with the Who. But, you know, decades before the 60s, she was kind of windmilling on her electric guitar. And, you know, she was never out as a queer woman. It wasn't something that she sang about like the other performers that I've mentioned, but you know, biographical details suggest that, you know, she lived as a queer woman. And I think the cultural aftershocks around her have definitely carried that image on, right? That like a queer Black woman invented rock and roll. And, you know, saying something like, I am a lesbian, I'm a queer woman, I'm a gender nonconforming person, like those labels weren't available to people then. It, you know, it was still, queerness was taboo in a way, and was criminalized, you know, especially in Black communities at the time. But the music was there, the lyrics were there. They were, you know, if you read them, like it's pretty clear what was being said, and just that friction of expressing the taboo through recorded music really helped to sell a lot of records, and was really kind of shifted what was possible, I think, for performers at the time, and is still kind of resonating a century later.
And centuries later, Sasha is right. In the sounds and aesthetics of today's pop music, we can see the impact of queer artists that came before. Many performers are directly citing history and culture in their work, and making sure those who didn't get their flowers then sure do get them now. One of the most meaningful recent examples of this that Jillian brought up, and that we're all still obsessed with, is Beyoncé's Renaissance album.
You know, that was an album that reached deep into the roots of Black queer music in this country, specifically ballroom and rogue scenes. And in order to produce what was an authentic experience, she worked with folks like Big Freddie and like T.S. Madison and folks who had, you know, invented entire genres of music, but certainly weren't selling out stadiums like Beyoncé can. And I thought that was such a fantastic example of bringing with you the people whose shoulders you stand on and making clear that this is not a singular project, but a collective project, that our culture is a collective project. And that something like, I remember when Break My Soul came on, I could hear Big Freddie's voice, like, what an incredible thing that this artist who I think a lot of folks in queer scenes had known, I think a lot of folks in like the pop and dance scenes had known, but certainly hadn't had anything like the mainstream success that she deserved across her life. And to hear her on a number one single was critically important.
Yeah. So to that point, I mean, the project of Renaissance was so celebrated because it was communal, because it felt like everyone was honored as a part of it. I think the other artists that I've seen recently become really popular and have quite a meteoric rise that I think is doing something similar, although a little bit different, is Chapel Rowan with drag performers. Every concert, Chapel is highlighting and bringing drag performers on stage, asking the audience to tip drag performers, highlighting drag as an inspiration, and her appreciation has been notably featuring local drag performers who are often not folks who are necessarily safe in all settings, in all states. I mean, I think Chapel's bringing even more of an audience to these local performers, similar in that notion of making sure you're honoring kind of whose shoulders you stand on.
Right. What I think strikes me as key to Chapel Rowan's sort of surgence of popularity. One, like her songs are enormously catchy. They are overly joyful, right? Two, I think they are, if you, you know, have Spotify's AI generate like a queer playlist, it's going to be, especially for queer women, it's going to be like very sort of sad. And there's going to be a lot of yearning, right? And Chapel Rowan is this really interesting, almost androgynous sound, because she is speaking to desire for women very explicitly. She's, you know, like Good Luck Babe, which is like a huge breakout pop hit for her. It's very explicitly about like, we were together and now you're back in the closet and with this man, but you're never going to forget about me. And it is
set, so Good Luck Babe.
Right. And it is set to like this soaring, like Kate Bush pop music in a way that I think, you know, borrows from a lot of divas, right? That borrows from a lot of, you know, pop superstars who I think are touted as like gay icons. But normally when that phrase is used, they're thinking of like icons for gay men. The other thing that's really unique to me about her is that if you look at Chapel Roan, like she plays with her aesthetic a lot, it feels very homemade. And I don't say that to put her down, but it feels very DIY. And I think that appeals to a lot of young women of this generation who are learning how to do this kind of makeup on TikTok, who are looking to, you know, design their own looks and to play with their own aesthetics at home. And I think like, that same, she feels scrappy in a way that I can't describe, like that I can't explain. And I think that appeals to a lot of her audience.
Chapel Roan DIYing the costume she wears on stage is a continuation of what we saw fans all across the country do while attending Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, Beyonce's Renaissance Tour, and screenings of the Barbie movie last summer. This era of queer femme music isn't coming to popularity in a vacuum. It's happening at a time when we see this concept of girlhood being plastered all over news headlines and discussed in think pieces due to the billions of dollars pouring into entertainment celebrating and catering to women and girls. This celebration of femininity is narrow, yes, but it is also an opening to discuss gender and its societal confines more broadly. In her weekly Substack, The Autonomy, Jillian wrote about Taylor Swift's queerness. And no, it's not what you're thinking.
I think first, it can feel very strange to bring up, you know, a incredibly famous and wealthy straight white billionaire in a conversation about queer music and about who is and who is not celebrated for being queer. But that sense that she is speaking directly from her own personal experience, I think is key to her popularity. And one of the things that I've noticed is that she, you know, thinking of like what you're describing is like the summer of girlhood, it seems very odd. Like Taylor Swift and I are about the same age, which means, you know, she's 34. And to describe like a 34-year-old is like an epitome of girlhood.
In a way that
we don't with other pop artists who are about her age. We don't talk about Beyonce that way. We don't talk about Adele that way. We don't talk about Rihanna that way. And it's one reason I suspect that is because they are all mothers. And Taylor Swift is childless, famously unmarried, and that she, you know, so many of her albums, so much of her music has been about her troubles finding true love, right? And then sort of over the course of her career, she becomes so much more, not just cynical about love, but simply more mature. And she also sort of, she begins talking about, especially around Folklore and Evermore, about wanting to be a mother, about wanting to pursue her own, you know, about wanting to start her own family. And at that same, you know, over that same trajectory, when Taylor Swift was sort of this overly doe-eyed portrayal of innocent white womanhood, she drew a lot of adoration from the far right. As she talks about like her own ambitions, as she talks about these entire lives, these entire eras that she's built for herself over her career, you've seen those same people on the far right turn against her and really view her as poisonous to the culture, as they mocked her as being at the Super Bowl. They're like literally doing one of the sort of icons of Americana, which is like she's the popular girl dating the star athlete, right? But they still viewed that as like disruptive because it was clear that whatever goal she sort of had towards marriage and womanhood, she was going to put herself first. She was going to act independently. And for, you know, the far right's vision of white womanhood, the one that they're writing into abortion bans, the one that they're using to restrict contraceptive access, the one that they're certainly using to target queer trans folks, you know, that level of subjectivity, that level of autonomy that she's exerting over her life, it's anathema to how they want the world to work, which is they need women like Taylor Swift to get married as early as possible and to have as many children as possible, right? And the longer she goes without that, the angrier and the angrier they're becoming with her, even if they aren't talking about those in those terms, because it's not just her. In fact, her life path that she's describing is more and more common, that more people aren't having children in their 20s, that they're waiting until the 30s. If they're having them at all, that marriage is no longer the start of adulthood, that it's in fact like culmination after you're comfortable, after you've, you know, built a career or these other things, that marriage feels like...
That it's not just heterosexual marriage.
Exactly, yes. That it feels like a very optional excess, like a very optional landing. So even as like it feels obviously very strange to bring, you know, this icon of like straight white femininity into a conversation about queer music, I do think that she is serving this purpose, right? That she's speaking to people's real experiences that we see in the data that they're having, that she's speaking to a sense of independence and autonomy that everyone deserves. And if it's just recently being denied to women like her, how long it's been denied and how many hurdles do women that are unlike her, women who are around, women who are fat, women who are queer, women who are disabled, right? How many hurdles do they have to surpass? So I think, you know, I'm a big fan of reparative readings. I'm a big fan that if something is popular, there must be a reason why. It's, you know, it's not just that it's being flushed with money. I think that there is something that people are seeing in themselves in her. And I think it is this real critical sense of independence, real critical sense of like writing your own life story.
I have like so many thoughts. I could make a really sort of persuasive argument essay if this was like, you know, AP English 3 or whatever, that I think Taylor Swift shifted the types of conversations, yearning, lyricism that could happen in popular music, and that who filled that space were a bunch of queer women who sort of rushed into that ecosystem, unsurprisingly, because of like the strong legacy of that exact type of work. Because, and this is my point too, Taylor Swift is also drawing from a huge queer backlog of, right? Like she didn't just fall out of a coconut tree. You know what I mean? She exists in the context
and all
of what came before,
of what exactly. She came from.
So it's like when we're talking about the yeah. Taylor Swift, I can draw a very straight line from the Alanis Morissette, Sean Colvin, Meredith Brooks, Sarah McLachlan, deeply white women feeling like when Paula Cole is asking, where have all the cowboys gone? Right? But like what she's done is created a world that feels real for the feelings she has in her album. And that verisimilitude of feelings is what Jillian was talking about, what makes her so popular. And I think that has what opened the window for other women and femme-presenting performers to have big feelings in public and know that there is a market for them.
Let me make this so simple for all of you. So simple. This summer, when it comes to pop music, if the lyrics don't describe the heart-wrenching loss of lesbian love, a naive young girl who falls in love with her best friend, tragic, backed up by some filthy disco beats, I don't want it.
The market for music about yearning and big feelings is thriving, with lyrics like Chapel Rowan's "Knee Deep in the Passenger Seat and She's Eating Me Out Is a Casual Now," or Billie Eilish's "I Could Eat That Girl for Lunch, Yeah, She Dances on My Tongue," playing on the radio and in the mainstream with ease. This is a far cry from the instances that were considered risque in music history decades ago, like David Bowie throwing his arm around his guitarist during a performance, the Beatles growing their hair long, Tina Turner performing in a flashy sequined dress on The Ed Sullivan Show, and Judy Garland jumping up an octave during the opening line of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Sasha refers to these moments as transgressions of gender norms that held cultural significance, even if not done by queer performers. Whether it's coded or not, queerness is all over music. And according to Sasha, this connection is inherently intertwined in the art form.
Historically, you do see music getting tied to queerness by many thinkers and artists. The earliest theories of homosexuality as an identity category did look at music as kind of central to what it meant to play out this, you know, third gender or deviant sexuality. Also positing that music was the gayest of all the arts, that there was this softness and fluidity and translucence to it, permeability. Something about like the throat opening up and then the eardrums vibrating and just these like orifices in communication with each other that is like so intimate and so direct that it kind of melts down the boundaries between people in a way that's like more powerful than maybe looking at a painting or sitting and watching a play. I think music in its intimacy and its blurriness gives cover to a lot of expression that maybe wouldn't fly in plain speech. I think there is an opportunity to say things about yourself without necessarily committing to them 100% or, you know, inhabiting them in an explicit way. It's not necessarily tied to you as, you know, an individual in society in, you know, the same way as professing an identity, during a political speech might do. I think there's this kind of fluttering of the curtain that happens where you can like peek out and like then retreat and have plausible deniability about what you're really saying about yourself. Because it is all a show. It is a performance. And so I think, you know, music has been a sphere where queer identities can beam out and find the people that need to hear the messages that are coming through without necessarily alerting the powers that be that might want to tamp down on that kind of expression. It's this like lateral selective communication that can happen. You're just kind of emitting just enough to tip off people who might be like you or who might benefit from knowing that someone like you is possible and can survive in the world in, you know, various covert or overt ways.
Queer music has definitely found its target audience and brought us all collective joy in the process. And that's why we couldn't end this episode on queer music without taking a moment to shout out the artists and projects we've been listening to at this moment.
Oh my gosh, what am I listening to? I mean, I'm still stuck on Beyoncé's Renaissance. I've been there. I tried to go to Cowboy Carter. I did it. And then I went right back to Renaissance. So like that's living in my head rent-free. Billie Eilish's new album is fantastic. Like legitimately, I'm having a great time. It is, yeah, it's raunchy. But like in a way where I'm like, oh, we're doing this. This is happening. Okay, let's go. Like and the production is killer. Omar Apollo, I just got put on to Spotify, finally decided I've checked enough boxes where they're like, here you go, try him. And he's fantastic. Chapel Rowan, obviously, which we've discussed a lot in this episode of the podcast. And then if I'm going to be really honest, I'm doing a lot of George Michael right now. Like I like went back in the archives and it was like, okay, wait, Freedom 90. Slaps, like Father Figure slaps, like Try slap, like the whole thing he was doing is so good. George Michael was like my first explicitly queer male artist that I ever like knew and listened to and like was interpreting the music as I was hearing it, knowing that he was queer. He was playing in a different genre. He was a, you know, a white guy doing R&B singing about men. And it was just, it really, really is really good.
I also loved Release from Album. I think it's fantastic. Also, we didn't aim for her, but Adrian Lenker has easily, like, one of my favorite folk albums that I've heard in years that came out about a month or two ago now. And Adrian Lenker, singer of Big Thief, who I've also seen in concert, who's really phenomenal and has this very unique way of communicating vulnerability. And who also has a very interesting push-pull relationship with femininity. And I also really love right now this band called Dehd, D-E-H-D, which is a indie rock band that I listen to when I run. It's very high energy. It's very punk rock. And it feels messy and slapped together, but still manages to have this like huge cinematic sound to it. Speaking of cinematic sound, I've also been listening a lot to the Challenger soundtrack by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Neither of whom are queer, but I remember being a sad queer goth teenager when I was like 13, 14, listening to Pretty Hate Machine and Nine Inch Nails. And it's so interesting to me to now see Trent Reznor making this like incredibly immersive, catchy cinematic soundtrack for a very explicitly queer movie that also has a lot to say about desire and femininity and capitalism.
Amazing. And I'll go last. The music that I have been enjoying, Billie Eilish's new album, I think it's fun and deep and sad. And Birds of a Feather is just such a good song. Conan Gray is another person that I have been thinking about. I obviously love Chapel Roan. That's no secret. That should be no secret. One lesser known person that I really love, Joy Aladokun, who is a Black lesbian singer-songwriter, folksy vibe, really good. Also comes from a religious background, so kind of explores a lot of themes of queerness and spirituality and religion and judgment and that experience. Nigerian American, so also explores a lot of immigrant themes in her work and writes a lot about her experiences struggling with different components of her mental health and life. And so highly recommend Joy. A nice like car ride listen, perhaps an airplane listen. When you're feeling wistful at 30,000 feet, that is a good Joy vibe. I, for one, am just excited to dance to all the queer music this summer because there's so much of it. That's why we made a playlist with songs by the artists mentioned in this episode and others we've been raving about so that you can dance along with us. To access the playlist, text KIKI to 82623. That's K-I-K-I to the number 82623. Got any queer anthems that we missed? Head over to our Instagram at ACLU_nationwide and send us your song recommendations on our story post. Your suggestion might end up on the playlist. Thanks again to Jillian Brandstetter, Stefan Smith, and Sasha Gavin for joining us this episode. And thank you so much for listening. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Until next week, stay strong.